We did not experience much turbulence, either on our flight out to London a month ago or coming back to San Francisco last week. Turbulence only really hit when I got to the office here on Wednesday. But it wasn't as bumpy as it could have been, thanks to so many of you who helped keep St. Luke's running smoothly. Thank you, thank you, thank you, everyone. Turbulent is a good word to describe the relationship between siblings Esau and Jacob in today's first reading. Even in the womb, they are struggling, so much so that Rebekah, their mom, cries, "Oy, if this is how it's going to be, why do I live?" God confirms that there will be ongoing conflict. Two nations are in your womb. They'll be divided, and the elder shall serve the younger. Even the boys, it seems, know from before birth that whoever comes out first gets all the good stuff, like a birthright and a paternal blessing. Well, Esau wins that first battle, but not without Jacob coming out holding on to his heel, almost like they're conjoined twins. It's a sibling rivalry that will last through most of their lives. Incidentally, about their names, I looked through a few biblical commentaries. Esau was too hard to figure out for the scholars I read, but later in the story, he's also called Edom, which comes from the Hebrew Adam, which means ruddy or red because he was a redhead, or as they say in England, a ginger. But I prefer my own explanation for why he's called Edom. When he comes home hungry after a hard day in the field, he cries to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stuff, for I am famished." Therefore, he was called Edom. Get it? Edom. Hungry. They called him Edom. Years afterwards, his friends would see him in the street and say, "Hey, how's that birthright thing going, Edom?" Anyway. As for Jacob, his name comes from the Hebrew Akeb, which means heel, because he was grabbing out of the heel. But somehow his name also originally may have meant God protects or God follows after, as in God's on your heels, looking out for you. Anyway, it's all very interesting, but honestly, I only did all that research about the name so that I could do my Edom joke. I know you're glad I'm back. One hard thing that happens when you're looking at biblical commentaries for sermon prep is that you find all kinds of fascinating details about a passage that you can't really put into the sermon because it'll then become like a hodgepodge of facts that don't pertain. A verbal turbulence, if you will. I'm sure you've heard sermons like that. But please allow me this one little tidbit. It's easy to miss, but note that in the first reading, Isaac marries Rebekah when he's 40 years old, but she doesn't give birth to the twin boys until Isaac is 60 years old. That means she has likely lived a painful 20 years of societal head shaking whenever she walks by. That poor woman. They'd never blame the man, of course. And that must have been really hard for her. So it kind of makes sense that after such a long time of barrenness, she would become so attached to Jacob, her youngest, the one who prefers to hang around at home rather than go hunting, to the point that she schemes with him later in Genesis to steal the blessing Papa Isaac should have given to Esau, the oldest. As a fellow mama's boy, whose mother insisted on introducing him as my baby into his teens, I can relate. Strong bonds. Apron strings. But the main point I want to make about the Genesis reading is this. Esau and Jacob represent two archetypes. Esau is all appetite and impulse. He's a big, brawny, fleshy, hairy dude, given to grand gestures and led by his emotions. "I am about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" he cries. And when he gets the food, he ate and drank and rose and went his way, as if losing his right to the family fortune meant so little to him in the moment because he was so hungry. He's kind of an oaf with big feelings. Jacob, on the other hand, is a bit of a softie, a quiet guy, a dreamer. He's maybe more ethereal. He hangs around at home and has smooth, uncalloused hands. He'd be a bookworm if there were books back then. He's also a lot more cunning. He takes advantage of Esau's impulsiveness and barters for his birthright, when a nicer brother might have just fed the guy with no strings attached. All three readings today present us with choices. Who are you going to be? How will you live? And what will you do with your birthright? If your birthright is your right from birth to be considered a beloved and precious child of God, will you give that away just to satisfy your appetites? Will you live as a slave to your impulses and emotions? Or will you tarnish your belovedness, your birthright, by thinking you are unworthy to be loved? Or will you, either with cunning or unwittingly, treat the birthright and belovedness of others as transactional, something that can be dismissed because they're either weaker or more vulnerable than you? There is a bit of Esau and a bit of Jacob in every one of us, isn't there? The attributes that we pick and choose from each makes us who we are. In his letter to the Romans, Paul also presents us with a similar-ish choice. Those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. To set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. It's actually helpful that Paul does not specify what he means here, because that leaves us room to apply it to our own lives and circumstance. What is flesh and what is spirit in your life isn't necessarily what is flesh or what is spirit in mine. But we can generally say that spirit is whatever helps you feel grounded in the love of God, whatever helps you see others and yourself with compassion. And flesh is anything that takes you away from that. Again, there is a bit of flesh and a bit of spirit in every one of us, isn't there? It's a good practice to check in with yourself as often as you can to see whether you are not teetering a bit too far into flesh territory, whatever that means for you. But it's also important to forgive yourself when you do. On my sabbatical in England this past month, I rediscovered something not so nice about myself. My impulsive Esau, my cunning Jacob, my fleshy bits. And it's this. I can be quickly judgmental and suspicious of others. A little bit it's hard not to be in my profession when all kinds of people come at you with their needs and their stories. Kind of like, okay. But one day when William and I were in Durham Cathedral, I saw a young man with long hair carrying a huge hiking backpack and wearing old medieval-looking clothes. He was dirty and scruffy-looking, and he had a walking stick. Well, immediately I did my internal eye-roll, inner voice thing. I thought the whole hippie thing was over decades ago. And I also assumed he'd be asking for money. A bit later, as we waited for Holy Communion to start in a side chapel of the cathedral, there was the hippie again. Oh dear, I thought. But William spied him and whispered to me, "I think that young man is on a pilgrimage, and I'm going to go speak with him." And off he went. Sure enough, turns out this man was walking from Kendal, a town in the Lake District, all the way to Lindisfarne, the Holy Island, raising money for a brain cancer organization. He dressed in period clothing because he is also a medieval reenactor of sorts. He had just hiked 86 miles in 5 days and was hoping to rest in Durham for the weekend. Soon, two little old British ladies started chatting him up, and afterwards one offered to let him stay at her place if he couldn't find anywhere else to sleep. So there I sat, steeped in my own judgment, while everyone around me was living in the Spirit. William later told me with excitement, "Can you imagine? We got to meet an actual pilgrim on a holy pilgrimage, and here in northern England, in an ancient pilgrimage site, Durham Cathedral, and he's dressed in that clothing. It's like we got to time travel. Well, he did. And the British ladies did. But I stayed in my own present time little bubble of judgment, condemned by my own pettiness. Who are you going to be? How will you live? What kind of soil will you cultivate in your soul? Christ throws all these seeds of love and opportunity for growth and blossoming in your path extravagantly all over the place. Will you let them flourish? Or will you stay tamped down in your own version of the flesh, led by impulse or cunning or anger or resentment? Such are the questions today's readings offer up to us. I pray that you and I can find a space to nurture what God has planted in us and not be distracted by all the turbulence that surrounds us, nor by the turbulence we create in ourselves. Amen.